Hello, people listening to this. I am Rahuldeep Gill, and I am responsible for the content of this podcast. If you like it, love it, or wish I would stop polluting the universe with my sound waves, I'd love to hear from you. Email me at rgill@callutheran.edu. Please, email me. I'm very lonely. This podcast is a little bit different from the first two that I have recorded. It's a little bit longer. It's a little bit more subdued. In this third podcast, I'm having a conversation with my colleague here in the religion department, Professor Jarvis Streeter, who is a legendary teacher of theology here at CLU and is an inspiration to so many, as he has waged a battle with pancreatic cancer for over a year now. Jarvis is one of my favorite people in this world, and I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was raised as a Christian. Yeah. So I went to Sunday school and did all of the normal Christian stuff growing up.
Where did you grow up?
Well, in the Bay Area, yeah. For the first 9 years or so of my life. And then when my dad got a job transferred down here in near Long Beach.
Oh, okay.
In a place called Seal Beach or Los Alamitos.
Yeah, I know Seal Beach.
Right. So, yeah, and so then I went to USC.
Go Trojans.
Right. Graduated from there. And I started off in the natural sciences.
Is that right?
Yeah, from the time I was, I don't know what it was, 4 or 5 years old, I wanted to be an astronaut. I was just fascinated with space. We didn't have astronauts yet, but I knew there were going to be astronauts at some point, and I wanted to be one. I wanted to do space exploration because it fascinated me.
Wow. At the same time, that sounds like 180 degrees different from what you do, but
yes.
Simultaneously totally right on with what you do today.
Yeah, it is. My love of science goes back, not just the space stuff, but I was also interested in dinosaurs, which were coming into prominence when I was a kid, and just other things about science in the world really fascinated me, and I wanted to know more about all of it.
Yeah.
So, on the one hand, I had this, my Christian side, and on the other hand, I had this love of science, and I never saw, any reason why they wouldn't go together.
Right.
I think I had this sense that, there's only one truth, and whatever's true in religion, whatever's true in science must cohere into a single truth.
Uh-huh.
So in some sense, my goal for my whole life, kind of more implicitly when I was young, but explicitly since college anyway, has been an attempt to put these two things together in my own mind, to just try and understand the way things are. So that's kind of that background. And then what happened was it was during the time of the Vietnam War, and I was fortunate enough to get a high draft number because I didn't believe in the war.
Yeah.
I saw no need for it, and all of these tens of thousands of young men being drafted and forced to fight and coming home broken, and I know a number of them who are broken and always will be broken to some extent.
But you were, even back then, you had the streak in you that you really didn't think of war as a necessary thing at all.
Not that war, anyway. Yeah. I mean, that was the one that was, in my face because I was potentially going to have to fight in it. So when I got a high draft number, I decided I wanted to serve my country, but to do it in what I thought was a more constructive way. So,
So what'd you do?
Well, I went through some non-governmental related agencies, church agencies in this case, seeking to go overseas and to do work in some other country and try and give what help I was able to give, but also to present in that way a positive view of our country.
Yeah.
And of Americans. And so I ended up in Kenya, and
That's the only
thing I was able to do that they needed was teach. I had a college degree, and that was very few over there. Almost unheard of to have teachers with college degrees.
Were you teaching English?
I was teaching math and science because of all my background.
That's right,
I had been a physics major for the first 2 years.
Right.
And then when the space program basically closed down and there wasn't really any future in that, at least as it appeared at that time, then I went into the social sciences because I was becoming more and more concerned with helping people and trying to figure out what was going on there. So it was kind of the natural sciences to the social sciences, which has been a very good base for me as it ends up.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I had no interest whatsoever in being a teacher. But since it was the only thing that I could do that was helpful, then I decided to become a teacher. And what I discovered was I kind of liked it. I thought it was really kind of interesting.
Hey, this ain't so bad.
Yeah. And the students really seemed to appreciate it. You know, they seemed to think I was a good teacher, that I had some ability here.
They were probably right.
Maybe. Yeah. So anyway, so I came home from that, you know, and that was very difficult, leaving there and coming back home into the war and into, you know, where I had lived, there was no running water, clean running water, had to boil all of it, no electricity, no gas, you know. So I had, there was no heat, you know, whatever you had, you made a fire in one form or another, you know. So to come back into all the luxury here and how everybody was taking it for granted, that was real hard. And so I didn't know what to do with myself, and I eventually took a job. And in that job, I had a very conservative evangelical supervisor who was always dropping religious tracts on me.
Handing things off to you to read?
Right, uh-huh, yeah. But he was just a really nice guy, you know, and very well-intentioned at all. And
what were you doing in the job?
I was working as an insurance adjuster.
Yeah.
My dad had been in insurance, and he said, well, since you have no idea what you want to do, why don't you try that out, see if you like it. Yeah. You know, it's been a decent occupation for me. So I did. And so what his doing this caused me to do is to think, here's a guy who's really serious about his faith, you know, and it is an integral part of his life. And if I really am a Christian, and if God really does exist, then that should be the center of my life. Because God is the center of all reality, if there is a God. So I sat down with a Bible and started reading through it along with a biblical commentary to help me understand what was going on, and a book on archaeology in the Bible.
Wow.
My science aspect kind of coming in. So I read through those things together all the way until the end of the historical material in the Old Testament.
You're still in your early 20s.
Right, yes.
And you're doing your own independent study.
Right.
At home on your own.
Right.
Of the Bible.
Right.
And doing a critical reading.
Right.
Of the Bible on your own.
And trying to, you know, trying to know more and make, a more intelligent decision.
It seems like you're really grappling with this text, which is something that we all ask our students to do.
That's right.
And you've done it.
Yeah. And so I came out out of all that with two conclusions. One, I was absolutely certain that God existed, even though I couldn't have told you why I had that certainty. But I was just certain of that for whatever combination of regions, and that I was fascinated by the Bible and by the customs of the times when the documents were written and so on. And so I put two and two together and thought, well, kind of like teaching, this stuff's fascinating.
Right.
I can be learning this stuff for a living.
You literally had a come to Jesus moment.
Yeah, or at least come to go to grad school and become a teacher.
Yeah,
and so that was my goal then. I decided there then and there. That's what I want to do is become a college teacher.
Is that when you ended up at U?
Well, it's first of all, I ended up at Luther Seminary, which was kind of a basic background.
Is that in Iowa?
No, it's in St. Paul,
Minnesota.
Yeah. It's the largest of the Lutheran seminaries and offered the most variety of things that were taught, and was recommended by a professor that I knew who was also a Lutheran pastor.
I can't wait to go to the Twin Cities at some point.
It's a marvelous place in many ways, except for weather. The weather is just awful almost the entire year.
But they're fascinating. I mean, it's the home of Prince and Michelle Bachmann.
Right.
Minnesota.
Yep.
Figure that one out.
So I went through seminary. Then, and what happened in seminary is I, learned more and more about the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. But that for me raised the question, well, then where does Jesus fit in all this? You know, Jesus is a Jew. Here's the Judaism, and here's what Judaism came to be like, you know, in the time of Jesus. Where does he fit in all this stuff?
Yeah.
So that led me to a study of the New Testament, right? And so I focused on the New Testament there, and then I did another master's degree at Yale in New Testament theology, primarily.
So you weren't even 30 yet. You had two masters.
Oh, yeah. No. And let's see. Well, and then the question of, okay, when I get a handle on Jesus, right, and who he is and what he was up to and all this sort of stuff in a historical context. And then that raised for me, well, what do we do with this stuff now?
How do I live?
Yeah, well, and how do we think about this? Because the New Testament, this is 2,000 years old in a totally different culture than we exist in. You know, and they think of heaven as up above the clouds and hell is underground.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. And we don't, you know, we don't look at things this way. So how do you translate that, kind of those views and those insights, how do you translate that into the modern world, and how does it fit with science and all of that? So I did another year as a research fellow there and worked on the interplay between theology, philosophy, and history in the 17th through 19th centuries. So basically the modern era prior to the 20th century. And in that process, I was applying to do doctoral work then in theology.
Right.
So then I went to SMU to study with Shubert Ogden.
Southern Methodist University.
Right. Uh-huh.
And Shubert Ogden, in those days, was he at the fore of this new way of looking at theology?
Yeah, he's
I mean, he still is in some sense.
Right, yeah. He's in his, I believe, later 80s now, and we're still in contact.
Yeah.
But he was one of the major theologians internationally in the second half of the 20th century. He's one of the greats, in my view.
Yeah.
And because the kind of theology called that's referred to as process or process relational theology, because that is integrates the work of Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne, both of whom were philosophers who tried to understand what reality would look like given all of the new science of quantum mechanics and relativity theory. They're trying to take that new worldview of science and say, how do we create an understanding of reality, a total understanding of reality, given what we learn from the sciences? Because Christianity has always, to some degree, been in dialogue with the sciences, because you want the you know, if you want your theology to be correct, you don't want to be saying some stuff that's demonstrably false, you know, as the sciences, what the sciences can do when you're talking about the nature of things in the world.
And here we are in the 20th century, and astrophysics has totally changed the way we look at the cosmos.
Right, absolutely.
And you know, other kinds of physics has totally look at the way that we look at the world from the micro to the macro and back in reverse.
Right, and it's not in every way the common sense world that we live in.
Right.
You know, at our scale of being, you know, we're a lot bigger than an atom.
Yeah.
And we're a lot smaller than a galaxy.
Yeah.
So we have this sort of a position of where we are, and the kinds of things we experience are based on scales of things. So what's common sense to us and seems to be the truth here doesn't apply precisely at all on the quantum mechanical level, quantum level.
And for you as a Christian, you needed to make sense of all that.
Right,
personally.
Yeah,
and you found in Ogden someone who could help you, could mentor you through that process?
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, could help me become more educated in that style of theology, and then I would see what I would do with it. But it made sense. And it was the only kind of theology at the time that dealt with science. And since I was a science religion integration as a person and as a goal in my life, that's who I wanted to study with and was fortunate enough to do so.
So for us non-specialists and or non-theologians, could you tell us something about process theology, the quick and dirty?
Yeah. Basically, it says that everything in reality is in process. It's moving, right? It's changing through time. And that comes out of course, the physics that says everything is relational and everything is changing through time. Evolution points to that and so on. And what it basically says is that God is also totally relational. Yeah, we're doing the theology, not the philosophy. God, interestingly, comes out of the philosophy as the source of all novelty, the ground of all novelty.
God is the source of everything that's new.
Yeah.
That's changing.
Right.
God is the source of
God's involved in the process of change, right? That everything moves from moment to moment, And the in process thought, the moment is an each moment is an individual thing, sort of like a pearl on a string.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is kind of more digital,
mm-hmm.
with bits rather than analog, smoothly changing.
Oh.
And in each moment, whatever entity it is, say you or me, we are affected by our surroundings, right? Everything in our surroundings has some effect to us and is a possible object of our focus and our concern, and therefore what we do in that moment, and what we do in that moment is ultimately is who we are in that moment.
Mm.
So you and I are talking. You are the most important thing in my focus right now, and what you say. And so I'm choosing to focus on you and to respond to you, right, in what I think is the best way that I can do that.
So awareness and our own being are really deeply tied together.
Exactly.
And those things are also tied really inextricably mm-hmm. to the divine.
Yes.
In every moment.
Right, yes. Because in this theology, in every moment, God is one of those things that is competing for attention. And the idea is that in each moment, God offers to you the optimal thing that you could be doing in that moment. And what God is, because God is perfect self-giving love, in the definition of Christianity, agape, God is not concerned with God's own self, but is ultimately concerned with us because we are loved of God. And what God wants is the best for us, and our, to find our fulfillment and help with the fulfillment of other people. So in every moment, what God offers is the optimal thing that you might do in that particular situation. And then you, in your freedom, can accept that and make that what you do, or you can reject it and pick something else.
So freedom on the human end and love on the divine end.
Mm-hmm.
Seem to be really, really instrumental in right. this way of thinking about God, the universe, right. and ourselves.
Yeah, because in what I would consider the proper understanding of Christianity, God wants, because God loves us, God wants us to find fulfillment, and the ultimate way that you can find fulfillment is in loving relationships.
But can we lean back and look at the Bible and see that?
Uh-huh, yeah.
How so?
Well, for example, in the New Testament, it says that God is love and is agapic love,
mm-hmm.
Something that's too often forgotten. People think love and they start thinking in human terms or in emotions and whatever.
Mm.
God is self-giving, totally self-giving.
Agape is a Greek word.
Right, uh-huh.
For a certain kind of...
kind of love, right, which is a love that is wholly concerned with the welfare of the beloved, to the point of being unconcerned or ignoring the self and what it wants. And that is what God is said to be,
mm-hmm.
this kind of perfect love. And God, knowing us better than we know ourselves, knows that which will fulfill us ultimately and lead to our greatest joy and fulfillment in life is precisely being in loving relationships,
mm-hmm.
and being able to give love to others and try and make their lives be better. And then love is that kind of love, agapic love, is returned normally, unless people are quite sick, you know, mentally or whatever they've undergone in their life. But normally that love comes back to you. And so in the giving of love and the receiving of love, that is the deepest human fulfillment that exists. And I believe that not only theoretically, but I also believe experientially, from my own experience of life, that is absolutely the truth.
Mm.
And that without those loving, deep loving relationships, life will never, no matter what you do in life or how much money you make or whatever else, without those relationships, your life will not be fulfilled and ultimately very happy.
Do you think, in how you think through theology, and in your this way that you're thinking about Christian theology, that is Jesus more important or is the Christ more important there?
Ah,
you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So yeah. So the sayings and teachings of this fellow mm-hmm. that we have mm-hmm. from 2,000 years ago,
right.
or is his crucifixion, you know, mm-hmm. suffering, crucifixion, death, mm-hmm. resurrection on the cross mm-hmm. important?
Right.
I mean, starting with Paul,
right.
it's the latter. It's the Christ. It's right. the resurrection.
Right, the risen Christ, because the risen, their understanding back then within Judaism and the groups that believed in an afterlife, not all Jewish groups did at that point, but in those that did believe in an afterlife, they believed there would be a general resurrection at the end of time, or the end of this world anyway, as it exists. And all people would be raised, and there would be some kind of a judgment, and some would go to live with God, and some would go to hell to be with the devil. And so when Jesus' closest followers, disciples, experienced Jesus as risen
mm-hmm.
to some new form of life, right? Mm-hmm. Not just a resurrected corpse at all,
mm-hmm.
but rather risen into some new form of life, to where he wasn't always recognizable, even mm-hmm. by people who knew him well. They didn't recognize him, or he appears suddenly through, you know, locked doors and solid walls, and mm-hmm. suddenly, right? There's a new form of existence. So they believed he was resurrected,
mm-hmm.
and therefore that he was the first, that this was the end of time, and that his resurrection was basically the first of all of ours, of everybody's resurrection. And there, so this is the end of time, and everyone will be resurrected. So he's particularly concerned about resurrection in that sense.
Paul is.
Because it tells what's going to happen to us soon.
And he really thinks, he dies in, what, 60, 64?
Yeah, probably 64-ish.
And he thinks it's just around the corner.
He does. He says...
We're going to take a new form.
Yeah, he says...
Universally, this is going
to
happen.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And he says to... In one of the letters he writes to a Christian church, he says, there are some of us who are alive now who will still be alive when Christ returns.
Yeah.
That didn't happen.
Right.
Didn't happen. So he was wrong on that one.
Minor problem for a Christian theology.
Right. But I think that becomes for him a reason why he is so focused on the risen Christ and tries to understand, to try and make sense of this guy. You know, what was going on with this guy?
Yeah.
You know, and especially his death. You know,
yeah.
Messiahs don't die. In Judaism, Messiahs don't die. They become kings.
Right.
And they lead, they throw out and defeat all enemies. You know, in this case, they would kick out the Romans. They would become independent. This king not only would be a great military warrior in doing this, but also a great spiritual leader,
yeah.
bring people into the Jewish people into a closer relationship with God.
Right.
That's what a Messiah was supposed to be.
And Paul, coming from a Jewish background.
Exactly. He's looking for this. He's looking, yeah. He's looking for a Messiah. Other people are looking for a Messiah. And people had claimed Jesus to be a Messiah in his own lifetime.
Right. So am I hearing you right that we should take Paul and sort of read back what Paul must have known about Jesus
mm-hmm.
and his sayings and his teachings.
Right.
And he's really excited about this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he interprets it in one way.
Right.
But are you saying that what we really should be excited about are those teachings and are those sayings and the life that is lived?
Yeah, I think it all has to be tested.
Okay.
I don't believe that everything in the Bible is from God
right.
or is true about God. I do not believe, for example, as in the first half of the book of Joshua, that God is a genocidal maniac who wants every man, woman, and child of the Canaanite people to be exterminated.
Right.
That simply cannot be if God is perfect self-giving love to everyone,
right.
not just to Jews, not just to Christians or whatever.
Right.
Right? That's unthinkable.
Mm.
Perfect love could never do that. I mean, it's absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah.
So, like an awful lot of scholars and stretching back at least to Luther, we have a sense that in the Bible you have human stuff and you have revelation, and that you have that some places you have the one, some places you have the other. And so the trick is to figure out which is which. And Luther, I think, was very insightful here and ahead of his time in that he thought that where you find human stuff is, in terms of talking about God, is where you see the kind of God that people think God ought to be,
mm.
a human vision of God, where God is this just judge, dispensing justice, giving people what they deserve, right?
Yeah.
And having all the power to control everything that goes on and so on. You have that view, but then you also have the other view of God, which is God as this perfect, agapic, loving Father, the kind that Jesus talks about.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Jesus never, ever, in any of the Gospels, refers to God as judge.
So we need to pay attention to his language there.
Absolutely. He always refers to God as loving Father.
And that's consistent.
It's consistent, right,
throughout
in his teaching.
How people have passed those teachings on.
Well, when they've done it well.
So this is a question. Is in the Christian theological tradition, philosophical tradition, sort of long intellectual tradition, mm-hmm. which as a Sikh, I'm actually kind of amazed by it mm-hmm. because we have a 500-year-old religion, and you know Christianity is four times as large and has this imperial influence and this globalizing influence.
That's right.
And this long set of intellectual tradition.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
In that intellectual tradition, how often is the agapic love emphasized versus mm-hmm. another aspect of the divine emphasized?
That's a very good question, and it varies depending on who the theologian is or which church you're talking about historically. My own belief is that Christianity has never taken fully seriously the notion of God's love as being agapic love, that it's a totally self-giving love. I've read theologians who have said things like, God created human beings so that there would be somebody to worship him.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
It makes no sense if God is totally self-giving love. Makes sense if God were like a human being, self-centered,
right?
And wanting people to go hamana hamana to him all the time.
That sounds familiar. That sounds like us.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds like what we would want. What we would think God would be based on who we are.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
We're creating God in our image.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that one of the reasons that agapic love has received so little attention in Christian tradition is a failure of imagination.
And the failure to understand what agape means, to take that term seriously. Every theologian talks about God being loving.
Mm-hmm.
Almost none of them ever mention what agapic love is and that this is the term that's used for God's love mm-hmm. in the New Testament. And because of that then, and because of this other judge sort of stuff that you find in a lot of places in the Bible, this human view of God, they've tried to take those two views of God, the judge and the loving Father, and to somehow put them together. And what they've ended up with is a mess.
Mm.
Because ultimately, in God's fundamental nature, God cannot be both judge, dispensing justice, giving you what you deserve, and loving Father, showing you mercy, giving you better than you deserve. The message of Jesus is very clear. This is a God who gives you better than you deserve, who's ready to forgive you at the drop of a hat. You know, the forgiveness is always there, just waiting to be, you know, received. Because the Bible is a mixed bag, Christian history has been a mixed bag. And out of that, then, you get all kinds of horrible doctrines.
Including God as warrior.
And that image.
Or Christ, you know, the warrior Christ.
Exactly, yeah. And even God the king, because out of that king notion, the king was the ultimate judge, the final judge in the ancient world.
Right.
So you not only get judged, but then you also get this sense of, you know, omnipotent power, that God can do absolutely anything that God wants to do.
But in your reading of Christian theology, that's not the language about God that is mm-hmm. the most important.
Right.
Or even descriptive.
Right, yeah. If you start always in theology from God as being agapic love, that has implications.
Mm.
For example, for God's power. Most people think God has and should have absolute power to do absolutely anything God wants. That's the normal Christian understanding, and I would say probably most people on earth would think that's what God ought to be. But if God is perfect self-giving love, then God's power is the power of love, right? I mean, if you love somebody, you don't try to force them. If you really love somebody, you don't try to force them to think the way you do or behave the way you do. If you have any sense, you know that they're free and you cannot force them.
Mm.
Coercion simply is not possible.
Again, freedom and love are bound up with
exactly,
together.
Exactly, exactly.
And
so So God's power is the power of love. And the power of love that we use is persuasion.
Yeah.
All right? And this explains then why the world is such a mess. If God were in total control, then why would there be wars? Why would there be, you know, tsunamis and hurricanes? And why would little kids be born with horrible diseases and die? If God is perfectly loving and God had that kind of power, then the world wouldn't have those things. It's just simple, basic logic. So that the world isn't like that, and we know the world isn't like that, that means God isn't in control, like so many Christians will say today, right? No.
Yeah.
God's in control, or, well, I guess God didn't want this to happen in my life because it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Like everything's, you know, God. Or everything happens for a reason, in the sense that God is controlling everything and making stuff come out that way.
And Christians today, it sounds like you're pretty frustrated with how a lot of your co-religionists mm-hmm. talk about God and how they act on
right.
those ideas.
Exactly, yeah. It's because, and it's because I don't think that the theologians and the church and their pastors have adequately understood the implications of God as perfect, self-giving love, seeking nothing for God's self, but wanting to give everything to the creatures. And it's not, for me, love isn't, the most important thing isn't about love, isn't it's a, that it's an emotion, it's a feeling, right? We can talk ourselves into saying, oh, yes, I feel love for this person, blah, 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 or whatever. The important thing about love is how you act
mm-hmm.
with those with whom you're in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It is acting always. If you're an agapic person, you are trying to act always to try and help the person's life be better in some way mm-hmm. by trying by your presence to inject some goodness into their day.
That's experience. Pretty. If I'm reading Lutheranism right, since I've been, exposed to it here in my last few years, that's a pretty Lutheran way to look at religion, is that theology and ethics can't be separate at all.
Absolutely.
Is that how we act, how we believe, have to really mirror each other.
Exactly. Yeah, the way you think shapes how you act. And in traditionally, Christian theology traditionally, ethics was understood as a subdiscipline of theology
mm-hmm.
for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've got to be thinking right to behave rightly.
Can I go back to a theological question?
Uh-huh.
Tell me then, what is the role of prayer? What can we as humans influence here? Can we ask God for things? Should we be asking?
Right.
What is prayer in your mind?
Yeah. Again, you start from God as being agapic,
mm-hmm.
perfectly loving. That means that in every moment of your life, in every moment of everyone's life, and I believe also in the moments of animals' lives and so on, God is trying to make their lives better, as good as they can possibly be.
Okay.
And this is why in each moment God offers God's will for you in that moment, which is that which, if you do it, will be the best thing for you and for all people.
Yeah,
that will lead the world forward into a more loving place, and where everyone's concerned with everybody else, and therefore there is no want or need.
Mm-hmm.
That everyone is there for everyone
mm-hmm.
and concerned about others, so you don't have to be selfish and self-centered and be all concerned about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ultimate vision of the reign of God on earth, or the mm-hmm. kingdom of God, as it's often called, translated. In the New Testament, so that's basically the whole thing.
What about the natural disasters? What about the tsunamis and the earthquakes and the superstorms?
Right. To me, in my understanding, God interacts with free individuals like us. Right. In each moment, God doesn't have coercive power, so God doesn't control earthquakes and tsunamis and diseases and stuff. God doesn't control them. But I think they are inevitable byproducts of nature.
Which is itself a kind of love.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, God creates a universe. However that exactly happens, we've got a lot of theories, scientific theories about it and so on. But basically, Christians understand that God is the reason for the existence of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
That without God holding it in being, And by that, I think we mean basically holding the laws of nature in being. Everything would collapse into chaos. There would be no order. Laws order things. And there are only really a handful or two laws of nature that fundamentally cause the universe to be the way it is. There are going to be unintended, you know, byproducts of things, just like in our lives, you know. There are things that happen that we have. We think we're doing something here, but there's sort of a byproduct of that that we hadn't seen, you know, and that causes something we didn't want to have happen, you know, maybe hurt somebody when we were trying to help the person, but we're not omniscient and we do the best we can, but sometimes, you know, the good we want to do isn't good enough.
So we could, so the universe then exists produced by a perfectly loving God, mm-hmm. but the world isn't ultimately perfect in the same way that we expect it to
be. It can't be, yeah. I mean, one thing that some scientists started pointing out in the 1980s or so was that the laws of nature and all of the laws and all of the constants are finely tuned to one another, such that if you take any of these laws or constants and change them even by a small amount, you would not have this universe that has the potential to bear life. Mm-hmm. So for the universe to bear life, it had to be, the laws of nature had to be very much this way and that way and the other way. And so, you know, I believe that God created through evolution, that was the mode God chose to create, and that the laws of nature were set at the beginning such that life would appear and molecules would self-organize. Life would appear at some point and then develop. And I think that one of God's goals in the universe is to have evolve creatures who not only dimly maybe sense that there is something out there. I mean, they wouldn't know to call it God or anything else. But what I think what God was aiming for, in part at least, besides giving everything existence, which is a wonderful gift, but is to have creatures evolve which had the ability to consciously understand the existence of God and to consciously choose to relate to God. And so, I believe evolution, if you look at the history of evolution, it's towards greater and greater complexity of beings, right? With us as the most complex beings, including our brains especially, the most complex thing that nature has ever produced on this planet. Mm. Who knows about other planets? I expect that evolution has happened on any planet where it was possible that life could exist, owing to the, you know, having fluid water, having certain elements present, and so on. So this is what I think the high point, the direction of evolution that God has wanted, is to have creatures like us.
So here we are back at the nexus of science and religion, which is how you got into this mess in the first place.
Exactly, yeah.
And at this point in your career, you're finishing a book on this very topic.
Right.
What's that book going to be called?
It's called God and the History of the Universe. And it's basically an attempt to tell the history of the universe, in some sense tell our story from its ultimate beginnings, 13.75 billion years ago, up into the present, and here we are. And what I do is I initially talk about the notion of worldviews, that each of us has some sense of the way reality is.
Yeah.
Even it may not be real formal, you know, it may be just kind of sense of things in our mind that this is the way reality is. But what I'm trying to do is then to show a worldview in which science is an integral part and is not contradicted by the theology. So that there is an integration of science and theology into a worldview where both of them are fully accounted for.
Who do you ultimately hope that this book reaches out to and touches?
General audiences. Most people don't know a whole lot about science. They could learn an enormous amount of just about some of the things they've heard about, because I do an introductory chapter on the nature of physical reality as currently understood by science. So I go through relativity theory, quantum mechanics, the kinds of particles that exist, dark matter, dark energy, the nature of space and time, according to relativity theory. So kind of get the scientific background. And then the majority of the book is just walking through the history of the universe, in which I tell our best understanding of that today, what happened. And then at the end of each chapter, I include a theological section, which relates in some way to that which happened in the chapter. For example, in the first chapter with the Big Bang and the first up to the first several hundred thousand years of the history of the universe. At the end of that, then I put a section on creation, on the Christian understanding of creation, and there are several. So one has to pick, but the fundamental assertion of Christian doctrine of creation.
Well, speaking of which, how do you think that these ideas are going to be received in Christian audiences? How do you hope they're going to be received?
Well, I say in the beginning of the book, in the preface, that who this book is not for, and it's basically not for dogmatists, whether dogmatists on the Christian side, who believe everything, they have no open-mindedness, they're not willing to consider something new or different, right? They've got their dogma, they're going to believe that, and there's no open-mindedness. So it's not for dogmatists of that Christian variety or any religious variety, nor is it for dogmatists on the atheist end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
People who will not consider, again, any new ideas.
I struggle with this too. And I've had, not only have I had students who are on either end of those, that continuum, mm-hmm. but also the world I look at, that we live in, mm-hmm. there's a lot of people who, in response to all the ideas that we have floating around them, mm-hmm. have turned to shutting down and right. shutting off in response to those.
Unfortunately, yes. I think that's the truth.
Don't we have any responsibility ourselves to bring them back into the conversation, or is it impossible? Mm-hmm. Or
right.
I mean, what do you think we should do there?
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that human beings can live a variety of different kinds of lives.
Yeah.
Some that I think, it's to me, there is a human potential. Humans have a potential to be loving in this way, right? To be people of truth and people who are trying to introduce goodness into the world and beauty. And so I think, our ultimate calling.
Yeah.
is to be this kind of person. It's a reflection, again, of what Jesus says, that for God there are only two laws, right? Or what God wants, and that is for God to love, to be returned to God, and to be given to everybody, mm-hmm. everybody, including one's enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the ultimate potential of humans, and that it is that which will only fulfill them.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, you will never be fulfilled. So that's what we have the potential to be. A lot of people don't think of that. They get all concerned with the day-to-day life, you know, or making money, getting rich, getting famous. And in that way, they are distracted from what their true fulfillment and proper full potential would be, to be agapically loving people.
And I mean, you can replace agapic love with, you know, life of the mind or love for expanding oneself.
Right, yeah.
And I see the students who, actually the majority of students who walk through classes here, mm-hmm. Who engage in that,
mm-hmm.
they are engaging in a kind of holy experience together, in a kind
yeah.
of communion in the classroom. And when mm-hmm. it clicks,
right,
or outside of the classroom, when you have those discussions like we're having right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, interfaith dialogue right here,
yeah.
it really feels like something special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm kind of I feel like an evangelist for knowledge.
Oh, absolutely.
Or the quest for knowledge.
Absolutely. I think all of us teachers are.
But when you're knocking on those doors, sometimes the people aren't answering.
Yeah, they don't want to. They're not there at that particular point in their life, and sometimes they may never be.
Yeah.
Because
love and knowledge and love and wisdom really right. seem to go hand in yeah. hand there.
Well, in my understanding, you know, the Greeks had this concept of the good, the true, and the beautiful, three primary things that they were concerned with and mm. thought of as being ultimates. God has been spoken of in those ways to a greater or lesser degree in the Christian tradition on occasion.
Truth.
Goodness and beauty.
Yeah.
And what I think is true is that each of those things is an angle from which one can view God. God is because God is love. Love is the ultimate truth of reality.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate truth of who God is.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate truth of who we can be.
Yeah.
It is the ultimate. So God is the ultimate truth, and therefore truth should matter to us.
Yeah.
And I think most people have a hunger for truth.
Yeah.
But it can get hidden, buried by other life concerns and so on. In the same way, I think God is the ultimate goodness, because if God is perfect love, that is the highest morality, the highest form of goodness that could possibly exist.
And the beauty.
And the beauty. God is the most beautiful thing that exists in the history of the tradition.
So,
because love,
art and religion. Beautiful. Well, art and religion then have a tie.
Right.
I mean, we do all of these things at the university.
Right.
And I really fundamentally believe that what we do at the university on our best days,
mm-hmm.
when those, you know, best angels are working,
is
worship.
Right. Yeah, I think goodness, truth, and beauty are holy.
Yeah.
And that love is holy, because this is what God is.
Yeah.
It's the perfection of all of these. And so I think as we concern ourselves with those things in various ways, like in art, for example, you know, some people are looking for beauty in form and whatever. Other people are looking for truth, trying to say something true about reality in some way, right? And perhaps give some sense of what goodness ought to be.
Yeah.
They're kind of different sorts of things. But but the ultimate of, I mean, these in a sense, they are strivings after goodness and truth and beauty. And I think that's what artists do, and what makes them special, especially if they're good at it and very much dedicated to it in that sense.
You're at a really important stage in life, which is you're looking surely at its end.
Right. Yeah, I will die within the next few weeks or months, and probably not very many. Yeah.
You're sick with a pancreatic cancer.
Right. Yeah.
But you've just been such an inspiration to so much of us on the hall.
Oh, thank you.
I feel every time I come into your office now, I really need that hug in the morning from you.
Well, thank you. Another one of those, exchanging love. It's very meaningful for me. We both win in love.
We do.
Everybody wins.
But I'm getting this feeling that this struggle between knowledge and spirit and mind and is really paying dividends here for you, and the work that you've done in that for the rest of us as we watch you and try to be with you.
Thank you.
And these really difficult.
Yeah, I've hoped so. I don't believe we have to be afraid of death. It again is a natural part of life, like diseases and earthquakes, whatever. And we don't like them, but that's just part of reality, which is necessitated by the nature of the laws of nature, which allow something like us to evolve and to be able to have a conscious experience of God and so on. It's just, it's part of nature, and it's going to happen to all of us at some time or place. And me, I'm lucky because I've lived to be 63. I've had a marvelous life. I've experienced so many amazing things, some awful things too, like everybody, but some really wonderful and amazing things. I've had experiences and travel and all that. And to me especially, I've been so fortunate to have a life of the mind where I am concerned about these things and always have been.
But in Eastern tradition, sometimes we think of the mind and the heart as bound. So we think of the mind-heart.
Right.
Yeah. And for you, I feel like the life of the mind has simultaneously been a life of the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
You've touched a lot of people in that.
Oh, well, that's... I've thought from the beginning, if anything about the way that I deal with my death can be of help to anybody else, then that's a marvelous gift to me, to be able to have my death be meaningful in that sort of a way. So a number of people have told me that they've gotten things out of my dying and my being open and talking about it and so on. And so I'm really grateful for that. It's just a beautiful silver lining to this whole cancer and death thing. And there have been a lot of silver linings, enormous outpouring of love.
I think one of the things that I've heard a lot of people repeat that you've said in the past is some people say, why me? And I say, why not me?
Right, yeah.
Well, why not you?
Exactly. I'm not special. I'm a human being like any other human being. Why should it be somebody else who's supposed to get this and not me? That's a very arrogant, self-centered way of looking at things. And I think, and the Christian tradition has taught that self-centeredness is precisely the problem.
And the Sikh tradition says the same thing. Yeah, I mean,
I think a lot of religious traditions, if not all of them.
I'm not one of those people to quickly say, well, our religions are saying the same thing, but literally, one of the first lines in the Guru Granth Sahib and the compositions of Guru Nanak is that the I, me, the me speaking out is the problem.
That's right.
And when we let God in and fill us, we get to diminish that part of ourselves.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's present. I mean, I'm not an expert in all religions, other religions, so it's, you know, I can only say from my reading, the impression I have gotten and of the global religions that I'm aware of, they're all very similar in the sense of we are our own worst enemy by being self-centered. Even in non-theistic traditions, right? You're the problem because you think you are ultimately an existent, you know, some kind of an entity that has permanent ontological status, when in fact you don't.
And in process theology, if everything is ultimately changing, you better also realize that you yourself are changing.
Well, you have the opportunity. The thing is, you've got freedom. So you have the opportunity to change for the better.
Yeah.
Or you have the opportunity to not change much at all, just continue on repeating how you've always done things in life, you know. Or you have the ability to change for the worst.
Yeah.
Human beings do things no animal would ever do.
Yeah.
We can be so subhuman, we can so utterly fail our potential as humans as to actually be sub what we should at least be as an animal.
Yeah.
We're live animalistic lives, and worse, some people do. But I think the people who do that are broken. They've been hurt so badly that, you know, that this is their lashing out, their response.
Well, I just want to thank you for the really hard psychological work that you've done throughout your life, and that you've sort of made so transparent for the rest of us.
Thank you.
And it's really hard spiritual work, and to say things are inspiration is sort of cliche, but I see that you have inspired so many of us. I can just look up and down the hallway to think of these things and to try to attack our own lives with a kind of vigorous self-cultivation that you're talking about and you've talked about today.
Well, that's marvelous. Again, that's what I've hoped, is that somebody somehow might get something, you know, out of their relationship with me in my situation that would be of some use to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Jarvis.
Now or in the future, whatever. But yeah.
Thank you, Jarvis. So,
you're very welcome. Thank you, Raldeep.
I love you.
Love you too.
All right. I'm going to end this podcast now, but the conversation continues.